Good afternoon from USC's Annenberg Media Center, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For Thursday, April 12th, 2018, I'm Nadia Caldwell. First, a news update with Leslie Ombreeze.
The March for Science is this weekend, and students and professionals are rallying, but why should we be paying attention? Camila Rios reports.
The second annual March for Science will be happening this Saturday in downtown LA. It comes a year after the original March for Science, which was called to protest the lack of political action on climate change. Jennifer Wheeler is one of the people who planned March for Science LA. She says they want to advocate for evidence-based policies in government.
Last year's march was really about galvanizing Angelenos around science. It got people excited and wanting to do more. This year's event is about shining a spotlight on the people and the organizations in Los Angeles who fight for science every single day.
One of the keynote speakers will be Dr. John Fleming from the Center of Biological Diversity.
I believe rallies work because it really shows how much people care about an issue, and decision makers actually do pay attention.
The Environmental Student Assembly at USC is inviting students to join them at the rally. I spoke to Claire Mouse, Assistant Director of ESA, about the importance of student participation at the rally.
All of us are studying at a research university, so obviously science and evidence-based research is really important to all of us. Our current administration has been relying a lot on alternative facts or not getting peer-reviewed science when they make statements. So it's really important that we tell our government that that's what we care about.
To join ESA at the rally, go to Tommy Trojan at 9 a.m. on Saturday, where ESA will be walking with students to the march. Check their Facebook page for details and updates. For Annenberg Media, I'm Camila Rios.
A win today for California. A federal judge ruled the U.S. Department of Justice cannot require local jurisdictions to comply with federal immigration policies if they want a public safety grant. Los Angeles filed a lawsuit last year when Attorney General Jeff Sessions said communities that don't cooperate with immigration and federal agents would not get the Community-Oriented Policing Services grant. U.S. District Judge Manuel Real ruled the Trump administration doesn't have the authority to attach new conditions to the grant because it was created by Congress. California is home to nearly 40 million people, and some of them are ready to split. Renny Svernovsky reports on the states you may soon call home if a billionaire's ballot initiative is passed.
Venture capitalist Tim Draper announced that his proposal to carve California into three separate states has more than 600,000 valid signatures. That's almost double what he needs to get on the November ballot. He plans to submit the Cal 3 initiative to election officials next week. If voters get behind it, the state legislature would have to approve it, and then the U.S. Congress.
This is something that's never been studied, researched, examined.
That's Democratic political consultant Stephen Maviglio. He co-chaired the effort to oppose Draper's 2014 initiative to split California six ways. If this one's approved, California's debts, assets, and institutions would be allocated among the new states of California.
Cost of doing this would be extraordinary to create three different everything, from prisons to universities to parks to pension systems to having three more lieutenant governors. It makes no sense at any level.
The three states would be divided into California, all the coastal areas from L.A. to Monterey, Northern California, San Francisco and everything north of it, and Southern California, which will include San Diego, Orange, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties. The proposal's odds aren't great, but Maviglio says he can't discount it in the current political climate. For Annenberg Media, I'm Renny Svernovsky.
Tonight, those clear skies are bringing a chilly evening with lows dipping into the 40s. Tomorrow, we'll see 70s across the board with winds hovering around 20 miles per hour and gusts reaching up to 40 miles per hour. Clear skies and sunshine will stick around through the weekend with highs in the upper 70s and low 80s. Right now, it's 69 degrees outside the Media Center at USC. Facebook said today it will stop sending money to fight a ballot measure aimed at giving users more control over personal data. The California Consumer Privacy Act would require companies to reveal personal information they've collected about a user and whether they've sold their information. Consumers could opt out of having their data sold. The move comes on a week where Facebook was on the hot seat in Washington. Angel Viscara has more on what USC students are saying about Facebook and the company's recent fallout.
In the past couple of days, it's likely you've caught a glimpse of a suited-up Mark Zuckerberg defending his company, Facebook, in front of the U.S. Senate over the sharing of users' personal data. I took to the USC campus to see what students are saying about Facebook and whether they feel it should matter to us at all.
It's my understanding that Facebook took our data and sold it to a third party, which then used that data to sort of help drive awareness for the Trump campaign.
I think people do have the right to be upset. I mean, I wouldn't want my info going out to Facebook, even if it's not so sensitive of info. It's just that it shouldn't be going out to people who don't need to see it.
It can be anything. It can be our social security number, even like small things like our preferences. It's just like kind of creepy and a little like horrifying to know that like people I've never seen in my life know every detail about me.
You just heard the voices of USC students Sean Hoffman, Hannah Yim, and Amir Sadvandi. For Annenberg Media, I'm Angel Viscara.
Union members of the LA Times released a report showing significant pay gaps for women and people of color at the legacy newspaper. The union says the data shows the Times publisher Tronc pays white newsroom employees nearly $20,000 more than non-white employees. Men are nearly $15,000 more than women. The data was based on salaries and demographics of 320 members of the union, which was certified earlier this year. The union wrote that the findings shed light on why the Los Angeles Times unionized after 136 years. It's 6 minutes after the hour. I'm Leslie Ambriz.
Thanks, Leslie. Coming up on From Where We Are, we hear from two Holocaust survivors who are reunited after 76 years. The 2018 midterm elections are only 7 months away, but these non-presidential elections historically have low voter turnout. So how do you get more people to the polls? Well, you throw a party. Angie Jean-Marie is the managing director of Vote Together for the nonprofit Civic Nation. Match Volume producer Thomas Carroll sat down with her to figure out what these festivities look like.
Vote Together is a national initiative to host parties at polling places. They've tested this technique 2 years in a row in 2016 and 2017 and find that doing community celebrations at polling places has a 4 percentage point increase in voter turnout, which is pretty remarkable. It also has a cost of $32 per voter, which in the political world is pretty inexpensive.
So take me to a Vote Together party.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like?
A Vote Together party, I think it can be something basic like a community picnic, something basic like a community gathering where there's a stage, a DJ maybe, or some entertainment. Previous Vote Together parties have had bouncy castles, things to engage all kinds of community members from 8 to 80. We are hoping to have what we're calling super sites as well, so huge, huge events. So thousands of people there where folks are coming together and really to celebrate the act of voting. And ideally, these parties are attracting, yes, people who are already going to the polls, but also attracting people who otherwise wouldn't have been going to vote that day.
So when I think of a polling place, I think of a very quiet space where you walk in, you wait in line. So this isn't actually happening in the room of the polling place.
No. So these can be at or near polling places. So it's not going to be in the room where you're going to cast your ballot. It could be an event that happened in the parking lot in front of a school, for example, or the polling place might be a school and there's a recreation center next door. And so the party's happening there. So it's not a party literally inside of the polling place where the machines are, but it's a party adjacent or sort of in front of the polling location.
Are you advising people on how to vote or
No.
just getting them to vote?
Completely nonpartisan. We don't have any screeners on ideology, any screeners on demographics. We want voters and non-voters alike to come. And so part of how we do that is all the organizations that we engage with have to do some direct outreach. That outreach will include things like doing door knocking. That means that if you're doing an event in a precinct, you're knocking on literally every single door, regardless of who that person wants to vote for, what their demographics are, any of that information. And I just kind of want to underscore why that's so important. millennials, for example, I can't remember what the number was, but a significant portion of millennials had never been contacted by a person who was running for office. That's the case with actually a lot of what people call low propensity voters. And so if you're lower income, people of color, younger individuals, there are times at which they're not contacted by anyone at all reminding them or urging them to vote. So Vote Together, because we're doing this thing that's about really building community cohesion, intentionally goes to seek out and get people, regardless of, you know, demographics, ideology, whatever, to come to the polling place.
This is such a simple idea.
Yeah.
Why has this never been done before?
So it's crazy. It used to happen. So there's so much about our political system right now and the tenor of it that I think is unlike where it's been in the past. So there's a really good, I think it's a New York Mag article that talks about voting as a community celebration. And so in the early 20th century, there were voting parades and huge celebrations on election day. And so we do have a history, and I was actually looking at something else where someone has receipts of George Washington buying booze for a party, for an election day party, which is really awesome. So it's not like this hasn't happened before. It happens at a somewhat limited scale. And what we're trying to do is make it a much more of a national movement and really returning to this idea of building community cohesion. Obviously, there's context that's different about, you know, now when our politics now and our communities now than compared to the early 20th century. But, you know, there is a legacy of having done this in the United States.
If people are inspired by this conversation, where can they go to sign up or get more info?
Yeah, you can go to civicnation.org/vote-together, and we're working on a website, which will be votetogether.usa.
Everyone knows about California surfing, but what about surfing the skies? Hang gliding pilots have done just that since the early 70s, bridging the state's mountains and blue skies and capturing the dream of flying like a bird. But over the decades, this California dream has faded as hang gliding schools and flying sites close. Erica Klein, a hang glider pilot of 10 years, gives us a bird's eye view of the sport's fight to stay aloft.
For some people, the California dream comes in a 20-foot long bag. Josh Lauffer pulls long metal tubes from the bag and unrolls the red and yellow sail to assemble a huge kite. The wings would span the length of a pickup truck, but the glider weighs less than 80 pounds. We're on a mountaintop more than 2,000 feet above Sylmar. In the distance, you can see downtown Los Angeles. Josh balances the metal frame on his shoulders and points its nose at the perfect angle into the wind. He's an instructor getting ready to take a student for his first flight.
You come up to launch, and you can just feel the glider just trying to pull you, basically try to drag you into the air. It starts to lift, it starts yanking on you, and it's like, let's go flying. It's like a overexcited pup that's trying to drag you to the park.
Josh's student, Mike Guittard, is getting that feeling for the first time. They're standing side by side as they get ready to run off the top of the mountain. Josh hopes students like him love their first flight enough to become hang glider pilots and help keep the sport going.
Okay. Right arm. Right there. Gonna be around. Okay. Ready?
Yep.
Start with the
walk,
Mike. Go. And we're flying.
Yes, we are.
Yeah! The ground falls away as they head out over the rolling foothills and join a hawk soaring above the ridge.
Woo-hoo. There's the red tail right in front of us.
Oh, that's awesome.
Pretty cool, huh?
They have the sky almost to themselves, but that's not a good thing. These skies above Sylmar were once home to flocks of hang gliders. The first U.S. national hang gliding competition was held here back in 1973. Now, flyers are scarce. Like many others, Josh's student, Mike, loves flying, yet this is his first time trying hang gliding.
This is awesome! This is what I imagined.
Josh and his partner, Andy Beam, recently took over the last hang gliding school in the region and are fighting to keep the dream aloft. Few young people are learning to hang glide, and many pilots in the aging hang gliding community have been flying for decades. Jim Heaton is one of these. Now 80, he walks with hunched shoulders, but he still flies nearly every week, and he has for almost half a century.
And the first time that I actually got in the air, I was flying, and I flew over my car. about 15 feet over my car and landed on the other side. And that hooked me right there. I just, wow.
Back then, hang gliding was popular.
It was almost kind of like a fad. I mean, there's something that doesn't cost that much money and you can actually go and fly. They didn't have parachutes. They didn't have helmets. We just flew, you know.
Try that with today's insurance premiums. Times have changed in other ways, too. And from the air, you can see how. Sprawling highways, shopping malls, and housing developments.
Yeah, and there's a lot of places that I flew that in the past that I can't fly there anymore. Either somebody built there or it's illegal for one reason or another or something like that, yeah.
He has no plans to stop flying. And why would he?
Some of the best flying in the world is in California.
Back to Josh.
So, you know, talk about a perfect dream is you can go to the beach and soar, or you can do a short drive up to the top of a mountain and find some of the best thermals in the world.
Josh was born here, but for him, California wouldn't be home without hang gliding.
If we didn't have hang gliding here, I don't know if I would live here. This is my main passion. It's not life without hang gliding. A little drastic to say, but, you know, I love the area, but I would definitely leave in a heartbeat if I couldn't do what I love most.
Josh trained to become an airplane pilot, but he's now dedicated to hang gliding. The feel of the wind on his face and the peacefulness found floating thousands of feet above the ground.
In the plane, all you hear is the sound of the engine, and instead I would go out to the desert, hear the wind, and go flying and just hear nature.
Hang gliding doesn't use engines, so it's classified as free flight, but it's not cheap. Lessons and equipment together cost thousands of dollars. Windsports is the last school in an area that once had many, and even without competition, Josh says they're struggling.
It was worrisome. There was times where me and Andy were thinking that we'd take more days off or just not, you know, report as many days that we were working. We'd still be working but not get paid, so we're willing to just start slashing at our own income, which is rough enough already.
The tandems help keep them going and increase exposure for the sport. After flying over the Hawk, Josh and Mike circle over the foothills far above the city and traffic. But every hang glider must eventually come back to Earth. After they've been up for about 15 minutes, the glider descends towards the grass, touching the ground with the thump of the wheels.
Yeah!
Yeah!
All right!
Well done, Mike!
And now, the moment of truth. Will Mike fly again?
Would I love it? Yeah, a lot. Would I do it again? Strong chance.
People used to dream of flying. Now, hang gliding dreams of new pilots. The sport is waiting for people like him to help keep the dream alive. I'm Erica Klein.
Today is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day around the world. Annenberg Media's Aaron Hindell went to the Museum of Tolerance in West L.A. to hear stories from survivors.
Seventy-six years ago, childhood best friends Alice Gerstel, now Alice White, and Simone Granowski thought they were seeing each other for the last time. It was the early 1940s in Nazi-occupied Belgium. The Granowski family had been hiding the Gerstels in their home. They arranged for a paid smuggler to help get the Gerstels out of the country. The Gerstels escaped in the middle of the night, after curfew for the Jewish people, and later made it to Cuba. But before they fled Europe, children from both families exchanged letters to keep in touch. Remember these letters. They'll be very important in this story. After that, Simone Granowski says, they lost contact.
10 months after my parents had helped their great friends, the Gerstel family, to escape from Belgium. The Nazi, the Gestapo, caught us.
Years later, White learned of the Granowski's fate. What she didn't know was that on the way to the Auschwitz concentration camps, the Granowski's train was attacked by the Belgian resistance. The Nazis regained control of the train, but in the scrum.
And by a miracle, I jumped off the train and escaped. Today, I'm so happy to be here.
Granowski's mother could not escape, and she died in Auschwitz. In 2002, Granowski published his autobiography, which included those letters he sent and received from White.
My nephew, James Friedman, was instrumental in finding Simon by entering my sister's and my maiden name in a search engine.
Friedman saw the letters pop up in Granowski's book. He contacted White, who was stunned to hear the news that her best friend was still alive. Through the Museum of Tolerance, Granowski arranged to come to Los Angeles. And just Tuesday, for the first time since they were 10 years old, Alice White and Simone Granowski reunited.
I know that 10-year-old Simone, whom I loved so much, resides inside this man, and that I am in the presence of a long-lost young boy, all grown up, who lived a lifetime, as did I.
The museum has an exhibit featuring photos of Holocaust survivors who have visited, which now includes White and Granowski. For Annenberg Media, I'm Aaron Hendel.
The USC community was shocked when a grad student named David Jonathan Brown stabbed his professor to death. Bosco Jean was killed in December 2016. Annenberg Media's Sam Burgum and Cole Sullivan have uncovered a story of troubling signs starting 2 years before the crime. Here's Cole Sullivan.
One of his colleagues described him as an angel.
First, he was brilliant. He was the sweetest, nicest guy you could have, and he was extraordinarily generous.
Professor Irving Biederman says he misses Bosco Jean every day.
He was such a good friend. It's so unfair.
On the last day of classes in December 2016, Brown stabbed John to death outside his lab. But our investigation has uncovered warning signs more than a year and a half before the crime. We begin in December 2014, when a search warrant says a grad student working alongside Brown in the lab noticed a change in his behavior. She started getting emails from him describing manic episodes. An LAPD detective told us around that same time, USC was first made aware of mental health issues with Brown. In June 2015, USC's Department of Public Safety says it got a report that Brown caused a disturbance in John's lab. A record of the incident says he was cited to USC Judicial Affairs. Then, a week later, a more serious warning from Brown's psychiatrist to Professor Jean. It said, quote, David Brown made a serious threat against your life. The warning was also sent to campus police and shared with university administrators. USC told us it took, quote, considerable action to ensure the safety of Professor Jean. A spokesperson says the school increased patrols around the lab, restricted Brown's access to campus, and alerted DPS officers. A former DPS officer who was on USC's threat assessment team at that time says they told Professor Jean how concerned they were about the warning, but said Jean, quote, didn't think the threat was serious. The officer says the team convinced Brown to take a leave of absence for fall 2015.
David's delusion was very complex.
That's Brown's public defender, Steve Schoenfield.
He thought the doctors in the neuropsych department were all conspiring against him and were actually doing human experiments on not only him but other students.
In 2016, Brown came back for the spring semester and continued his work with Professor Jean. USC says Professor Jean advocated for Brown's return to the lab, and Brown's attorney says Jean wanted him back in the program.
He was his biggest advocate, and they were friends.
USC says there were no incidents after Brown's return. A DPS sergeant told us, quote, when Brown came back, there really wasn't a system in place to make sure he was all right to come back. Then, 17 months to the day from the written warning that Brown made a serious threat against John's life, he stabbed him to death.
Cole Sullivan and Sam Burgum, who reported that story, are here with us now. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Nadia.
One of the questions that stands out to me here is, how was David Brown allowed back on campus?
You know, that's one of the biggest questions in this case. The short answer is, we simply don't know. The university and Brown's lawyer says Professor Jean was a mentor to Brown and actually advocated for him to return.
But we don't know who at the university okayed it. We asked a USC spokesperson that question, but the statement he gave us didn't identify who made the final decision to allow him to come back to USC. We approached Jean's department chair about it too, but she declined to comment.
So where is David Brown now?
He's in Patton State Hospital. It's a state mental hospital in San Bernardino County. Before that, he was in jail for about 15 months. Last month, a judge found him not guilty by reason of insanity. He could be in that hospital for the rest of his life.
You quote a DPS sergeant in your story who says there wasn't really a system in place to make sure David Brown was okay to come back to the university. Has USC made changes?
Yeah, they have, Nadia. In the months after the killing, they completely reorganized their threat assessment team, and they hired a new chief threat assessment officer, Patrick Prince. The deputy chief of campus police told us they now have a better system in place to make sure people don't, quote, fall through the cracks.
And I spoke to that new chief threat assessment officer for this story, and that full interview is on our website, uscannenbergmedia.com.
And the full investigation is on that site, too. Cole and Sam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Every year, hundreds and thousands of people from all over the world flock to Indio, California to attend the Coachella Music Festival. Among them, as always, will be many USC students. Reporter Victoria Berggren surveyed students planning to attend this year's festival to find out why they're forking over big bucks to attend and what they know about the festival's history.
Most of this year's crop of student festival goers weren't even in preschool when Coachella debuted in 1999.
Who's the first headliner ever?
Is that the Rolling Stones? I have no idea.
Jesus, no. I don't know. Like, I feel like they always have, like they have people like Snow Patrol way back when, but I have no idea.
It was actually Beck, and the price to get in was a bit different, too. Nowadays, the cheapest standard ticket will set you back more than $400. Back then, you could get a day ticket for just $50.
No way! Yeah. That's amazing. That's so weird.
And that $400-and-something price tag, that doesn't even factor in the cost of food and drink and a place to sleep. Time magazine did the math and found that the most affordable option, where you camp, have a general admission ticket, and bring your own food and drinks, will set you back more than $600. And that's the lowest rate. If you start adding other comforts and features to your festival experience, the price can rise to well over $8,000.
Do you think that it's worth it? Personally, I do. I know that a lot of people feel like it's maybe too mainstream for them, but I think if you're thinking about all the money that you're going to logistically spend on seeing people, like if I would go see Cardi B, Beyonce, and The Weeknd, it would cost me more than $375 just to see the three of them, and so I think it's worth it.
I think it depends. You're budgeting out like $700, so it really just depends on like if you're going with a big group, it's worth it, and if you're going to see people you actually like. But in terms of like the actual art festival, like I don't really think it's necessary to go every year.
Side note, unlike USC students Logan Dallas, Carrie Cavaney, and Kaylin Elizabeth, who were barely walking, two of this year's headliners, Eminem and Beyonce, were already touring when the first Coachella festival was held. This is actually Beyonce's second time on the lineup, but it will be her first time performing. She pulled out of last year's festival because of complications during her pregnancy. For Annenberg Media, Victoria Berggren.
FinFu also helped produce this story. Today on Street Smarts, Kaylee Wells takes us on a drive down Fairfax.
Fairfax Avenue is small but mighty. It actually used to be Crescent Avenue, and no one's quite sure when it was renamed. But it was sometime before Fairfax High School opened its doors in 1924. It's not one of LA's most famous, it's not long or wide, but it packs a lot of history in its five-mile stretch from Hollywood Boulevard down to La Cienega. So let's take a quick drive. As we head south, we'll pass by Canner's Jewish Deli. It's been around since 1931, and since it was open 24 hours a day, it was a popular hangout for musicians and fans after the Sunset Strip clubs closed. In fact, for much of the 20th century, Fairfax was the center of LA's Jewish community. 100 years ago, this stretch was home to airfields and oil fields. Right here, the Gilmore family founded the oil company by the same name after Arthur Gilmore drilled for water on his dairy farm and struck black gold. He opened Gilmore Stadium in 1934, which was home to LA's first football team, the Bulldogs. That same year, the LA Farmers Market opened right next door, and today, more than 100 vendors still set up shop every day of the year at Fairfax and 3rd to sell fresh food and souvenirs to tourists.
We ate tonight at Fairfax and 3rd. We're gonna spread the news.
In 1952, the stadium was demolished, and CBS's Television City rose in the same spot. Countless shows are produced there today. And at the right time, we might see some people lining up around the block to try and catch a taping of The Price is Right.
Diane Lorenzen, come on down!
After we cross Olympic, we're transported to another country. A business district that transformed to an Ethiopian enclave in the 1990s. It was called Little Addis after the capital of Ethiopia, but in 2002, the city named it Little Ethiopia. It's the place to go for injera, the Ethiopian version of tortillas and bread. Heading south, Fairfax passes radio station K-Rock, cuts under the 10 freeway, and merges into La Cienega Boulevard, humbly conceding to its wider, longer cousin. With Street Smarts, I'm Kaylee Wells.
That's it from Where We Are Today. Follow us on Facebook and Annenberg Media. I'm Nadia Caldwell.